ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm Peter Martin, host of The Economy Stupid, where we find economics in relationships.
She only wants a man if he's really, really good.
In the Reserve Bank board.
I knew. Everybody on the board knew recession was coming.
And in food.
It's about the cup of diesels required through the life cycle to get that chicken patty on your burger.
The Economy Stupid. Search for The Economy Stupid on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf. I'm Kate Evans.
And I'm Cassie McCullough. And each week we talk fiction, Australian, international, and Kate, even today, intergalactic.
Intergalactic and in translation. But the other thing that we really must do, Cassie, is acknowledge the poet, novelist, playwright and librettist David Malouf, who died last week at the age of 92. Such an important writer. And one of the things that I've been so taken by this week is actually hearing and seeing so many other writers talk about his significance, his generosity, his influence on his work. Writers like Christos Tsolkas, Chris Neen, just so many of them,
yes,
talking about him.
Yeah, clearly a huge figure both publicly but privately as well in the book world.
Well, here's critic and publisher Geordie Williamson speaking to Radio National's Sarah Lestrange about why Malouf mattered.
So he was just one of these incredibly literate and sophisticated in terms of his culture, because I think the important thing to note is, though he wrote first for Australians and he wrote very much about Australia, he was interested in the idea that we as Australians are always using the language of the North, the culture of the North, to translate concepts across so that we could understand our place here in this country.
And you can find the rest of that interview on ABC Listen, as well as an interview with David Malouf by Claire Nichols of The Book Show that was recorded just last year.
Yes, both well worth a listen, and I do think there will be more about David Malouf in coming weeks.
But today, alien encounters and stories of abductions in Amanda Laurie's Capture. Tom Wright is reviewing that one with us.
And pilgrims, adventurers and bandits at the roof of the world in Deepa Anapara's The Last of Earth. And Hannah Kent, superstar novelist, will be reviewing that for us.
But we'll kick things off by weeping tears of blood in France and creating blood feuds in Bulgaria.
So, Kate, I think it's true to say in the last few years we've become a bit obsessed with the International Booker Prize.
It's been running for 10 years this year, and so much extraordinary writing is celebrated through that prize and through the shortlist. It's the very best.
We've found some absolute gems going through it. So if you haven't come across it, this is a prize given four books in translation, the very best from around the world, anything that isn't written in English. And so it's a great way to get these little surprises, little surprise packages.
And over the next couple of weeks, we're going to read as many books in the shortlist as we can.
And why don't you do that too? I mean, there's only six of them, so it's not that hard. So why don't you read along with us before the announcement? When's that, Kate?
The 19th of May.
Right.
And in fact, why don't you send us emails with your thoughts on the books as you read them as well. We'd love that. But Cassie, let's begin with two: French novel The Witch and the Bulgarian novel She Who Remains. Why don't we begin with that French novel,
okay,
one that you've read?
All right. Now, this, I mean, I was just attracted by the title. It's so good, The Witch. It's worth saying right at the beginning that this book was actually written in 1996. And it's only just been translated now. So it's an early novel from Marie Ndiaye's oeuvre. She's a French novelist, playwright, screenwriter. She's now got more than, well, a dozen or so books to her name. And the first one she wrote when she was just 17 years old. She has a Senegalese background, which I think informs a lot of her writing. So that's just worth knowing.
So this new one, Cassie, it's called The Witch, as you said. So who is the witch?
Well, that is a good question. We begin in this book with a woman called Lucy. She is a witch in suburban Normandy. And we learn quickly that she's not really the most powerful witch in town. In fact, her mother is a spectacular witch, and others around her have really excelled. But Lucy, not so much so. You know, she really hasn't managed to do much with what she's inherited. She has these twin daughters, Maud and Lise. And for 11 months, ever since they turned 12, she has been trying to inculcate them in the family tradition, in the mysteries of what they've inherited. And for 11 months, she's been taking them down into the basement of their suburban home, this empty, cold place with a few paint cans in the corner and just a concrete floor. And she's been trying to teach them what she can. Her husband upstairs knows about it. He's sort of a bit disgusted by it all. He's not interested at all. And the girls aren't that interested in it either, which is a bit disappointing.
And what sort of powers do they have? I mean, I guess there's lots of different ways that somebody might be a witch. And so what sort of things is she teaching them to do?
What she can do in a limited capacity is get glimpses of the future and of the past, and even little glimpses of the present, but not where she is. And when she does this, tears of blood roll down her cheeks. And so she's trying to pass this on to the girls. And Maud, who's the really sort of, you know, stroppy daughter, she says, "No offense, Mama, but really it's just all so lame." Read on. "That was their only comment on joining the ageless procession of occult-powered women. I find myself wondering if they really believed in it at all. Their way of cleaning their faces seemed so cool, so final, so relieved, as if the ceremony at the end, they could now never again subject their practical minds, eager for tangible, productive sorts of knowledge, to such idiotic exercises."
So these girls sound like classic teenagers with a bit of attitude. You said that they're in regional France. So how do these sort of powers or skills play out in the community? I mean, do other people know that she's a witch?
Well, there is this other character called Isabel, who is a neighbour. And Isabel, well, Lucy has made the mistake of telling Isabel about her powers, optimistically thinking that she could initiate her, because there is a way of passing the gift on to women who aren't inheritors of it. And she thought that Isabel seemed like someone who was really important and could be good to have on her side in the neighbourhood. That turned out to be a catastrophic mistake, because Isabel is totally lazy, avaricious, and a bully. And so as soon as you meet her, you think, is she really the witch of the title? And yeah, there are many other points in the book where you might also think that. So Isabel's this, well, let me just read again. "Stocky and stout, bulging in stretch wear, her hair bleached, her face proud, obtuse, inquisitive. She strode from house to house, one hand tugging her son, never failing to castigate him copiously if he stumbled or fell, if he whimpered in fatigue, in short, if he got on her nerves in any way." And this is poor little Steve. I'm not sure why he's called Steve, but he is just this poor little guy. And she wants to know, is he going to make it, you know, to the Ecole Polytechnique when he's older.
So power rather than magic. I mean, is this about sort of ordinary lives or extraordinary lives? I'm sort of wondering how the witchiness plays out in this novel.
So I'm making it out as if this is a comic novel, and it is in part, but it's also deeply psychological. A lot of what's going on in Lucy's life is dysfunction. There's the husband slash father who's not really interested in anything that she or the girls are doing. He has a job basically at a sort of club where he dresses up like he's one of the patrons, but really he's just selling timeshare to the chain's other clubs. There's her concern about her parents who have broken up, and she desperately wants them to get back together. And it's not too much to say that early in the novel, her marriage breaks up and there's complications with the mother-in-law and, you know, the sister-in-law. So it's really about, I think, women and the way women's lives are disempowered through a range of mechanisms. But that's perhaps a little dry. Actually, do you want to hear a little of what Jordan Stump, who is the translator of this novel, said about what he thinks this book is about? Now, just remembering that this was written 36 years ago, and Jordan Stump is the person who is actually being nominated for this prize, even though it is Marie Ndiaye's book. So here's what he believes the book's about.
What her books are about, largely, is loss and disappearance and absence and abandonment and aloneness. So that's what's going on here, you know. And many of her other books talk about that, you know, the kind of that feeling of simply being dropped by the world. And it's more complicated than that, because in other books like that, it's the lead character who has somehow turned against something that they actually are, etc. But there is a kind of very, very basic human terror, the terror of abandonment and loss, that is at the heart of this. And then there are questions of style and of imagination on top of that. But at the bottom is something that I think we all share, that terror of somehow everything that I have simply being taken away from me.
Yeah, he puts that so beautifully. And his translation is, as far as I can tell, not speaking or writing or reading French. It's so clear and so economical. Just by the way, Jordan Stump there was talking on a podcast called Harshaniyam, which is really interesting. It's originally translating work into the Telugu language, but you can find a link to it via the International Booker Prize website, and it's well worth a listen. There's lots of material there.
And I guess that's one of the other things that's so powerful about this prize, is that it celebrates both the translator and the writer, and together they are nominated and somebody's going to win it. So The Witch, sounds, Cassie, like you really admired this one.
Yes, I really enjoyed it. And it was interesting to read a book that has spent so long untranslated that feels so fresh to today's, not just, you know, literary culture, but also screen culture. I think witches and the occult are very much part of our daily consumption now. But what's also interesting is that this writing of Marie Ndiaye's comes from a distinct period in French literary history. I mean, it's only 30 years ago, but it's from a publisher called Minuit, and it was very much that beginning of postmodern writing about objects and putting all ideas and putting them on the stage, which I think we all remember from, you know, the 90s. But this was the French publishing house that really took it on. And it itself came out of the resistance in World War II. So it's very, from the outset, a very political set of ideas in this book, which is the house style of that publishing house. The daughters are fascinating and disappointing. The neighbour continues to be interesting, but it's the entire breakdown of everything this woman, this fair to middling witch, thought she had, that is what will stay with you.
It sounds really quite something. And an interesting counterpoint to the novel that I want to tell you about, Cassie.
Yeah.
Because it's by a new writer. This is her debut. This is a Bulgarian poet, screenwriter, playwright and actor called Renée Karabash. So a Bulgarian writer. The novel is called She Who Remains, and the she in the story is a really interesting figure because her name is Bekia, and this woman is living in the Albanian mountains, and she's living a very harsh life in a family where her father wanted a son and not a daughter. And as the story opens, this character, Bekia, is making an oath to be a sworn virgin and to live as a man under the name Matiah. And this is something, and the novel explains this at the beginning, this is something that she can do under an ancient canon law, but it's spelt canon, K-A-N-U-N, where women can agree to take on the sort of the cultural role of men, the clothes of men, they can put womanly things away. And so that whole setup made you feel as if you were reading a very old story up in the mountains. And then things happen and you realize you're actually reading a contemporary story. And that this person, who we're now going to call Matiah, is the last of the sworn virgins. And so there is a woman journalist who's being addressed at times who has come to collect this story. And so you're trying to make sense of what on earth is going on, why this person has made this decision, what's led them to it, how you understand even the structure of writing, because it's written in quite an unconventional way. There are no dialogue marks. There are hardly any full stops. And it reads a bit like stream of consciousness, and you're just immersed in this very harsh world and this sort of circular story that you're trying to make sense of. And it is absolutely fascinating. And at first, it's just a bit of a wild ride, and you just have to hold on and figure that you're going to work out what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Is it based on a sort of tradition, like a real world tradition?
It is a real tradition that happens across a number of countries, not just Albania. There is a cultural relationship between Bulgaria and Albania that plays out in the story. And there is a relationship between an Albanian woman and a Bulgarian woman that's also at the heart of the story. So there's a sense that borders are being crossed, things are being transgressed. There's also a sense of a violent underpinning to the story as well, because the reason, and this isn't a giveaway, we find this out reasonably quickly, the reason that Bekia wanted to do this act and swear to be a sworn virgin is because she was going to be married off, and it was an arranged marriage, and she didn't want a part of it. And the only way she could get out of it was to take on this other sort of cultural, different gendered role. But if you do that, that is a huge insult to the family that you're going to marry into. And so this sets up a blood feud. Somebody is going to die. Things are going to be enacted. There's going to be vendettas. So none of this is taken lightly. And these vendettas and acts of violence go back to her father, who never wanted her. This is also played out in the language. Apparently there's a word, a Bulgarian word, sin. It's the word for boy and it's the word for the colour blue. And it's the same word. And so the translator has to actually let us know about that. And they are translating into English, which is a sort of gender neutral language, from Bulgarian, which I understand is a highly gendered language. And the way that it's spoken and written, you can even tell the gender of who's speaking. And so that playfulness is rendered with a really light touch in this beautiful, beautiful work. But it's a story about gossip and stories that people know in the community. And so the more you read this book, the more you get to understand all the characters and you see how complex it is. But it's not written in a conventional way. So there's a secret at the heart of it. There's tragedy, there's longing, there's love stories, and you're trying to work out why she's made the decision, but you're doing it by tracing around and around these events. It's fragmented. By the time you get to the second half, you're just totally caught up in it. But at first you have to read your way into it and into this culture that reading it from Australia was totally unfamiliar to me.
So a contemporary topic, I guess, in the, well, I guess what we might call trans now, a trans story, but revealing, of course, the endless roots and history of that.
Yes, and it's also a queer story as well. It's also about forbidden love. It's about escaping a small town. It's about all the things that small towns can do. So it feels transgressive. It also feels quite visual. And as you did with the reading of The Witch, I found out more about the translator, Isadora Angel, who is also a really interesting thinker, a Bulgarian woman who now lives in America. And again, on the International Booker site, you can read interviews with both of these writers, and it just opens up these texts in ways that are just fascinating. But it's a small book. I read it quite quickly. I was totally immersed, and it's not like anything else I've read.
Okay. Well, She Who Remains, written by Renee Karabash and translated from the Bulgarian by Isadora Angel. What a great name. Okay, well, that's the first two on the International Booker list.
More to come.
And you've got till the 19th of May to read them all if you want to read along with us. Well, let's say hello to this week's reviewers. Back with us on the bookshelf is novelist and scriptwriter Hannah Kent and theatre writer and artistic associate at Sydney's Belvoir Street Theatre, Tom Wright. Hello, both of you.
Well, hello.
Hello.
Hello. Yeah, great to have you back. Look, Kate and I have been, just to start on a slightly down note, Kate and I have been talking about the loss in recent weeks of David Malouf, the great writer. At the age of 92, Queenslander and legend. David Marr described him to me in the corridors the other day as one of the greatest Australian writers and poets, of course, of all time. Kate, you've read some of his work?
I have. And as I looked at my bookshelf, I had the little David Malouf section, including the copy with still rather childish-looking writing on it to me of my own name and the date 1991 of David Malouf's The Great World, which was one that I really got swept up in at the time, but hadn't reread until the last couple of days. And I mean, I am really interested in war stories, but I like the way that he took the vernacular and then kept on undermining it and shifting it. And it's a story that covers like 70 years. What about you, Tom Wright?
Malouf was a profound influence. I think I speak for so many people, particularly of my generation, because we read him at school. And if we were lucky enough, we read him at university as well. That's the joy of a career of that length. And I learned to read by reading Fly Away Peter and An Imaginary Life. Those books taught me how to think about history and about character, and the elegance of his prose stuck in the mind. Years later, I read a book like Ransom. It didn't have quite the same impact. But when you met David, as I was privileged enough to do, what a gentleman and what a generous mind and a man of sensitivity and insight. He wrote about the Jewish diaspora. He wrote about the Lebanese diaspora. You said, Cassie, you wrote about Johnston Street and the Queensland growing up in there and on the other side of the river in Brisbane. All of the he represents the growth of the 20th century in our country, and it's a profound loss. One of our major writers has gone.
Yes, I do remember watching him one day at an event. It was at the Sydney Opera House. I think it was the Commonwealth Writers Prize announcement. And the way he was looking at the room, I was wondering how he would be turning it into words. And I guess, you know, we'll never know. But
across so much, could speak about art, could speak about classical music, could speak about the nature of cities around the world. A thoughtful man, and in many ways a different type of Australian mind, and one we should celebrate. So, yes, I must admit that my breath caught in my throat a little when I saw that David had gone.
Yes, we read Jono at school. You're spot on, Tom. Hannah, any thoughts?
No, much to my embarrassment and regret, I haven't read any David Malouf. I'm fairly certain I would have read perhaps some of his short stories at university, but certainly none of his novels and none of his plays. But for people like me who sort of, you know, he's one of the holes in my reading history, is there a way that you could summarise the nature of his writing or the concerns? I mean, such a long career. Was there something that you think defined Malouf other than his reputation within the literary landscape?
Well, one thing that the critic Geordie Williamson has said of him is that in his early decades, he was somebody who was looking outwards from Australia and dealing with language. He was somebody who read Proust in French, for example. But one of the things that Geordie drew attention to was the fact that as the decades went on, he began to look at Australia in a different way. So a book like Conversations at Curlew Creek is about the conversation with First Australians. And so he wasn't somebody who just stayed in the same mode. And I guess the other thing to say about David Malouf is that he saw himself first and foremost as a poet. So even as a playwright and even as a playwright, he was interested in the work that language could do. And I think that's something that we can hold on to as readers. Mm.
And I think there will be a lot more memorialising of him in weeks and months to come. I think there'll be lots of retrospective reimaginings and rediscoveries of his work. Well, let's turn to the book you've read for us, Hannah Kent. It's called The Last of Earth, and it's by Deepa Annapara, who is a novelist from, and a journalist actually, from India, who now lives in England. She's also written a novel called Gin Patrol on the Purple Line, and that's not Gin, G-I-N, which would be an excellent novel. It's D-J-I-N-N, as in little mischievous spirit. And she's also edited a collection of letters to a writer of colour. But this new one, her latest, is called The Last of Earth. Maybe, Kate, you could set it up for us.
Okay, well, we're in 1868 in India, heading towards Tibet. So in this period, what's important to know is that Indian traders and pilgrims could travel into Tibet, but European foreigners, especially the English and the Russians, they couldn't. It was illegal for them to go into this kingdom at the roof of the world. And this then is the story of two English people who want to cross that border. There's an English explorer, a man who wanted to survey and map the place, the captain, and an English woman, adventurer and writer, Catherine, who also wants to get across that border for her own reasons. But significantly, what this novel does is it tracks the story also through the guides and the other Indian characters, who as much, if not more, the story than these white characters. So, Hannah, if we step on the road with these people, we're on foot, of course, we meet the English captain and his troop first. So who's with him?
I think the most significant character that we are first introduced to is that of Balram, who is this surveyor spy who works for the English captain. Because he is Indian, he is able to enter Tibet, and he is also familiar with the route, so he's acting as a guide. But he has also been trained by the English in the ways of surveying. And this is some, I think, one of the hooks that first grabbed me with this story, when you learn of the ways in which these men, of which Balram is one, have been trained to survey without any obvious instruments, because of course this group cannot go into Tibet holding compasses or having any sort of papers or notebooks on them. So Balram is someone who has been trained to take a certain step, a step of a particular distance every time he goes, and he is counting these. He's also been sent on previous missions for probably about the last 8 years, but he's a someone who I think occupies a very troubled, nebulous space within this group. He's aware that he's serving the intentions of this captain. This is a man who is intent on, who feels he has a right, I guess, to map Tibet. He's very much committed to the British colonial project. He's sort of imperialism dressed up in a man. And Balram is troubled by this. And yet at the same time, he's aware that being a surveyor spy like this, he is able to, I guess, have more freedom than he would at home, especially with the certain domestic environment that he has found himself in. So Balram is someone who is also, I think, quite, it's important to say, he's also someone who, even though he's serving these purposes, he has also got a mission of his own, a very private, secret mission. Growing up, his best friend, Gyan, was another Indian who was trained by the English to be a surveyor spy, but he has been missing. He never returned home from his last mission. And rumour has it that he is being held captive in a monastery after being discovered as a spy for the English. And so privately, and I think motivated by desires and yearnings that he's not even willing to articulate, Balram is not only going forward with the captain, but he's also hoping that he will be able to find Gyan during this mission as well. So, and I think most of the, alongside Balram, we have other men who Balram feels responsible for. He's hired them. These are men who aren't so much there as surveyors. They're there largely to take the sheep and the goods and all the necessary instruments and supplies that they will need for this incredibly arduous journey. But yeah, he's a troubled man, but he's a very compelling character. And it's really through him that we are also introduced to the captain.
And the captain never has another name. He is just this Englishman who has to dye his skin and his hair so that he can be in disguise, because it's really important that nobody recognises that he's English. And he hides his notes and his compass in a prayer wheel. And occasionally they have to say to him things like, don't use a prayer wheel to pick your fingernails. Like, that's really disrespectful.
The captain is an absolute joke.
It's ridiculous.
Because they're going through so much harsh weather and it's raining all the time. So as you say, the captain is someone who dyes his skin, I think it's with iodine and walnut juice, and dyes his beard and his hair with ink. But because it's always raining, this dye was just kind of dribbling down his face. And he's so convinced in the security of his disguise, which everyone else around him knows is just pitiful. He's very much, he comes close to buffoonery sometimes in his own self-righteousness and his own sort of commitment to his ideals. But yeah, he's a very rigid man. He's very determined. And like I said, very committed to, I guess, the ideology serving the British Imperial Empire at that time.
But meanwhile, the parallel story with this woman, Catherine Westcott, who's 50 years old, and she's there with her guide, Manny, who's a young man who's training to be a monk. Now, she also has to hide her notebooks. She has to put her money, you know, deep in the trunks that she's carrying. But she doesn't have to stain her skin with walnut, does she? So what do we realise about this Englishwoman?
Catherine is a really interesting character. We learn, I think, over the course of some time that she doesn't have that, you know, she's not particularly fair. Her skin is darker. She looks to all intents and purposes like she may be Indian, but she herself is quite unwilling to examine her own history and her own ancestry. She's unwilling to look at her parentage. She refers to a woman that she calls mother back home in England, someone who has always, by the sounds of things, been only absolutely critical of her. And she's aware of herself as an outsider. But we first kind of are introduced to this feeling of being on the edge of things, of being on the periphery and of not belonging through this desire to go and have adventures and not be sort of wedded and bound by children back home in England. But over time, and mostly through the responses of others around her, do we learn that in appearance, she's certainly someone of mixed race. And it's very likely that her father sired her with someone that, you know, she's not really very interested in knowing who. I think I was really interested in the hypocrisy that I think underlies a lot of Catherine's thoughts and actions. She's someone who on one hand might identify as absolutely English, and she adheres very strictly to some of the social mores, for example, and also in the, let's say, incredibly racist attitudes that she can have towards Marnie and the other people that she meets. And yet on the other hand, she's kind of repulsed by a lot of what we might consider to be English as well, especially when it doesn't serve her intentions to be free and to go and explore. She has hidden her history as much from herself as I think from the other people around her. And I think much of her journey is a kind of reckoning with her origins and with the people who might have made her and the various places of belonging that may well be open to her, only if she will then respond in kind.
That is a great creation of a character and an embodiment of that dilemma. So just to be clear, her mother was Indian, her birth mother, but she was raised in an English family. Do the locals see her as Indian at all, or what do they make of her?
Well, this is the really curious thing. In appearance, I mean, she's wearing this, what is described as a bonnet of fur, which is kind of in a state of decay. You know, tufts of fur are always coming out over her, and she's quite shabby. She's dressed like a local. She's, you know, she's living rough. She's you know, camping out. So she's very much of the place. She looks like a pilgrim. She certainly doesn't have any of the airs and graces that the captain, even with his walnut juice, sort of, you know, holds close to him. But we don't really understand exactly what she herself feels. And sometimes it'll be in these moments where she wants to set herself apart, and she sends money outside to sleep, even in the most brutal of weather, or she sort of starts treating him very much as a servant, as she feels is her right. Then she appears very English. But then at other times you see this real desire to see the world and to leave behind all those trappings and those specifically, you know, gendered limitations at home. And then she is able to more, you know, easily fit in with the people that she meets. So I think her Englishness, what she might deem as her Englishness, and what she might deem as her Indian background, really it's like a seesaw. You see it sort of, you know, emerge and then fade away again, and it's all coming from her. It's all coming really from her attitudes and her ideologies and her various longings and her, I think, increasingly, you know, she has a lot of, I think, what I would describe as increasing discomfort about both of these things. And it's really interesting, I think, very cleverly done by Deepa to show the ways in which sometimes she is very much an English lady, and in others she is renouncing all of that. It really comes from her rather than from anything as concrete as a physical appearance.
And so the book is mostly structured around these two parallel journeys and these groups and the mud and the cold and the discomfort and just the work of trying to get over these mountains and cross these borders. But then there's this other character who's not part of either parallel expedition, who disrupts everything and sort of disrupts the narrative. He is fascinating. So for a long time, I just thought of him as the stranger, then the handsome stranger, and then the charmer.
Uh-oh.
Well, exactly, Cassie. He's a man. His name is Chitak, or he calls himself Chitak. And he comes in and out of the story, and he's almost like this antic folktale type figure, and we're not quite sure where he fits in. He sings this note, almost like a bell, and it's almost a note of politics and disruption. I mean, what could we say about him, do you reckon, Hannah?
Well, for so long, much like you, I was sort of, the fact that he does appear out of nowhere and that he seems very knowing, he seems to very, very much understand things about Balram and Catherine that we don't even understand, or they don't even understand about themselves. He sees straight through to the, sort of the secret truths that they hold within them. And for those reasons, I was thinking, you know, is this a spirit? Mm. And it's not such a crazy thought to have as a reader because, you know, this is the path that these characters are walking is very much on the brink of earth, you know. It's this liminal space, and both of them are haunted, deeply haunted by ghosts. You know, there are apparitions. The men that Balram and the captain are travelling with, you know, talk about ghosts appearing, and the snow leopards appear as something greater than an animal. They are also this sort of following menace. So it seems within that context for someone to always pop up and understand exactly what Balram is really after and to see through Catherine's secrets, you start to think, okay, yeah, is this a ghost? Are we in a sort of an altered space or place right now? But ultimately, and this I think hopefully doesn't give too much away, is something much more, I think, interesting than that. He is someone who has carved out his own path and is probably the only character in this very wide range of and wide cast that we meet who has successfully followed their own path and is very, very sure with what, you know, about what he intends to do and how he intends to do it. His ideologies are secure, but in a very different way to the captain. And I think that that is a really interesting point. This is someone who has sort of absorbed the world around him and determined his best course of action, whereas around him, whether it's Balram, whether it's the captain, whether it's Catherine, people are sort of very rigid and ultimately in this place of, you know, this landscape of transmogrification and ambivalence and change. He's the only person who has learned to kind of accommodate those and yet still continue on his intentions. It's such an interesting character. I loved him. He was wonderful.
He's so beguiling, and he works as a force to critique colonialism, but he's not anachronistic. And I think that's an important thing to say. It feels as though this is a novel that is very cleverly embedded in the history of the late 19th century and all the changes that might be coming.
Well, that sounds great. The Last of Earth, it's by Deepa Annapara. And, well, it looks like a chunky book. How long is it here? So it's about nearly 400 pages long. So, yeah, but easy to read, apparently.
You'll rip through it. Much faster than these explorers, no doubt.
You're listening to ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf, your weekly broadcast and podcast all about new fiction. You can follow us on ABC Listen, where you can find 9 years worth of book recommendations.
That's a lot of books.
I'm Cassie McCullough here with Kate Evans and our reviewers this week, novelist Hannah Kent and theatre writer Tom Wright.
And we're turning now to Australian fiction and the latest from novelist Amanda Laurie.
Amanda Laurie has written 10 novels, including The Morality of Gentlemen, Camille's Bread, and The Labyrinth, which won the Miles Franklin Literary Award, the Prime Minister's Literary Award, and the Voss Prize in 2021. I loved that book. Then The Conversion from 2023, which I'm ashamed to say I haven't read. But now, Tom Wright, Capture. Let's start with who or what is being captured here.
This is the story of a psychiatrist by the name of James Mather, who's coming towards the latter part of his career, clearly is at something of a crossroads, and when he meets up with an old mentor, she suggests to him that he should devote the latter part of his career, or at least whatever is in front of him, to the business of getting down and understanding those who claim they've been captured, abducted, and investigated by aliens. UFO visitations. And he has the response of any other creature or man of science, as if to say, why on earth would I go into that realm? But nonetheless, his interest is piqued. And what we then get is in the age-old tradition of the psychological set of pen portraits, of case studies. We follow Mather as he goes through interviewing these men and women who very rationally, very calmly, and without any sense of histrionics or self-service, begin to proceed to describe the visitation of aliens. And it's all the stuff out of the cliches out of books. It's the saucer that comes down with the spinning green lights underneath it. It's little people who are bald with big eyes who take you bodily into their craft, and case after case after case is laid out. And so Laurie is very carefully, almost clinically, to my mind, deliberately, coldly tried to recapture that sense of psychiatric / psychological analysis of particular case studies. What's riveting about it is exactly what I've just described. You find yourself deeply emotionally engaged with the strange disjunction between the simple rationality and calmness of the way those who claim to have been captured describe their experience and the utter meshuggah, the nuts of their actual claims of what's happened to them. One chap is in Kazakhstan in what he describes as a part of the world which is good for nothing. He's in a quintessential nowhere space, and he's taken on board a ship and has the most transformative experience, and yet he's able to sit there calmly in Mather's room and just talk it through. So this is the setup. We're dealing with a central protagonist who may well be coming to question his own practice and his own systems of knowledge, coming up against a group of people who are widely disparate, but the one thing they have in common is they have a set of stories. And then we realise maybe 100, 120 pages into this book, we're in the realm of fable here. But the question, Kate, is fable about what?
Well, and the whole fable question, I mean, there's an author's note at the very beginning of this novel that warns us, quote, "What follows is in the nature of a fable and is in no way intended to portray actual psychiatric research or therapeutic practice." So that was a curious thing to begin with, because you're reading it as if this is indeed the sort of exchange that happens. Why do you think she felt the need to say that and to point out to us?
Well, it's a caveat, isn't it, which every writer would like to be able to hold, which is you don't want the people who pin you by the lapels and say, look, as a clinical psychiatrist of 25 years' experience, I can say that X, Y, and Z wouldn't happen. And it's a classic case of not seeing the wood for the trees. I think Laurie wants to retain a novelist's right to invent a set of paradigmatic examples here and sort of say, look, please don't treat this as an example of how we treat people who claim to have been abducted by aliens. Let's look at the way in which we think about these as a set of mythological provocations. Because this is what is so interesting about it, is this stuff starts to feel biblical. And it's interesting in discussion over the course of the program today, we're going to a metaphorical high mountain and holy space, but it's not an actual climb up the Himalayas into Tibet, this case. It's a heightened space of the mind. And so many of these characters that psychiatrist made the interviews say, maybe I made it all up. What I'm getting at is they're not wedded to the idea of being believed. They're quite calm about the idea that they might not be believed, or the idea that all of this might be actually taking place inside their mind. None of them are insisting upon being taken literally. And maybe that's Mather in this case is akin to the novelist saying, well, what do we believe and what do we not?
Because they all, or almost all, insist that they are rational beings who were just living a regular life. And then something happened. They were flying a plane and suddenly they were sucked out of the plane. They had these encounters with aliens and then they found themselves back on.
Or they're camping in the middle of nowhere, or they're in a driving down a bush track. But there's a unifying factor which starts to connect these various case studies, and that is not only are the majority of those who have been captured subjected to sexual assault by alien beings, but they are made to understand by those alien beings that the reason they are subject to these assaults is in order that a global intergalactic breeding program can take place, and that their DNA is being replicated in tubes through these vessels. And the aliens seem curiously keen to make our subjects aware of this, that it isn't all just random research. You are part of a grander project. And this is where the sort of the grandiosity and the ego of the subjects comes into play. And suffice to say, Mather starts to question his own practice. And so we're in, again, a familiar trope, but not handled in a cliched way, of the all-wise, all-seeing, perspicacious narrator who starts to doubt the very foundation of their practice. It's not the stories that are unbelievable. It's psychiatry that becomes the problem.
Although you mentioned ego and this narrator, Jim, has quite the ego, and because it's all told from his perspective, and he insists to us that he is somebody who people like and who people are drawn to, and that he can tell these stories. And he's doing that while coming across as not a particularly likable person at all. I mean, not that likability is the issue in fiction, but when this narrator claims himself to be likable, that's what's sort of interesting about it.
I thought exactly that, Kate. I thought it was so interesting that Laurie was so prepared to make our narrator prim and a bit of a prig, and very pleased with himself and very certain that he was the holder of the cup of knowledge. It's hard to write a book when you find, as a reader, you find yourself judging the vessel through which you're being told the story.
And maybe judging the premise as well, because alien abduction is pretty silly.
Well, is it, though? I mean, I think it's interesting to just pause for a moment on that. I mean, just this month there was an episode of Australian Story about the 1966...
Westall.
Victorian school, where not just the children but the staff and people in the street and in the suburbs around it claim to have seen.
Actually, the Westall case is alluded to. Laurie alludes to it without actually going directly into it, Cassie, but yes, very much so. Again, it's completely consistent with all that. And the book's smart. It doesn't just say, oh, did this actually happen or not? It's not a binary. It's prepared to entertain other ideas, Jungian ideas of a collective, you know, emergence from our collective subconscious or whatever. There are different ways of thinking. It's not trying to say these people are mad, insane, or deluded at all. The book's not in any way seeking to suggest that there's any sort of sense of evasion of the nature of this. It's taken quite seriously.
Yeah, well, that's, I guess, what I'm trying to get at. There's something more in these stories than something that can either be laughed at or taken incredibly seriously. It is a yearning for What else?
I mean, as a psychiatric project, it's how do we understand these narratives and the stories we tell about themselves? And then there's this really interesting point, and it happens about halfway through, where Jim, the narrator, meets up with an old friend of his who is interested in mythologies and stories and says, look, you can look at any culture and everyone has their way of encountering and describing these things, whether they're fairies, elves, pixies, flying angels, wheels of fire in the sky, Sanskrit scriptures, flying chariots. So that for me made it more interesting as it stopped being in so much detail about the aliens and started to be a little more cultural in the understanding. Although having said that, and I just want to go back to something you said earlier, Tom, you use the word cold, and for something that can be part of family stories and family mythologies and passionately believed, the style is quite sort of cold, removed, intellectual in a way that sort of affects your reading of it. It's quite sort of distant. Uh-huh.
Now, this is interesting, and I wanted to know this because Amanda Laurie has that very, very precise, clear writing, which is lovely, and you feel so safe with her.
And you get Laurie in both modes here, Cassie. Like, you get the flinty. If you don't like the word cold, it's flinty. There's a flintiness to this character, which is extenuating the kind of the hotness of the subject matter in a way. But you also get Laurie's poetics. And there are some phrases that you're in those sections you're talking about, Kate, not just when the old theologian says, look, Jim, we're surrounded by gods. And you get a different models and different ways of thinking about existence offered to you in this really quite cold, flinty, rational way. The one that stuck out for me was in the aforementioned section in Kazakhstan, this very rational young privileged man just saying, there are parts of the world that are good for nothing. And then another section, the world is changing all the time. And these sentences just hang on the page of Capture, but after a while they start to ring with the impact of a very large bell. This is a book that's thinking out loud about actually time and space, the dead and the living, and who comes back and who gets to stay. So there's all sorts of prospects, and you find your mind as a reader thinking, oh, I'm very intrigued to know what Jim Mather's going to make of all of these cases when he puts it all together. Is he going to write a book? Is he going to make a television documentary? Is he going to ascend into space himself and join the chariots of the gods? What's going to happen?
And there is another character with whom he is working this out, and that is the woman who is his sort of researcher and assistant. And she's a really interesting, really important counter to him in that she has a sort of different analytic force, and he's still trying to work out what he makes of her.
Yeah, I'm not sure how successful this character is. Dr. Cheng is the sort of is employed. She's at a crossroads in her professional life as well. And in, towards the end of the book, she thanks Mather profoundly, saying, when I needed work, you gave it to me. And they have this sort of odd relationship of mutual dependence for a while there. But I don't know quite how three-dimensional it felt to me, the idea that he needed to share these processes, or quite what her purpose was. Maybe I missed that one.
Or whether she's being set up to be a sort of muse character, which in itself is something that has to be checked and tested.
Yeah.
But again, it's because we're getting it from his perspective, and he's saying, oh, there was nothing going on. It wasn't that I fancied her or anything. It's like, really, Jim? Come on.
Yeah, he's sort of, he's a very unreliable narrator, and that is the great irony that Laurie's playing with, is that it's actually not those who are captured who are the unreliable narrators. It's the one who's seeking to analyse them.
Do you think she could be an alien?
Yes. Everything's possible here.
Amanda Laurie's Capture is published by Text.
Time now on the bookshelf for a regular segment that I particularly love. What have you been reading, and do you recommend it? Let's go to you first, Hannah Kent.
I've read some great books lately. I've just read Chloe Dalton's Raising Hair, which is sort of a memoir, nonfiction account of Chloe, who sort of stumbled across this very injured leveret baby hare and, well, raised it, as sort of it says on the tin, but in a way that was very hands-off, very respectful. And really the book, as much as it is about hare, this animal which she never names, it is also about her own ongoing process of learning how to be respectful of the wild world which surrounds us, and also just to see it. Really beautifully written, very simple, very easy read, but yeah, gorgeous, gorgeous book.
It's not fiction.
It's non-fiction.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it happened to her during COVID when she was, because normally she works in international policy, she's very busy life, very driven, and then suddenly found herself at home in this place where she lived amongst farmland. And a gorgeous account of what it is to sort of be humbled by these inadvertent encounters with what is wild, and to learn so much about yourself, of course, but also the wider world. So in some ways, a sublimation of self and ego into a deeper interest of nature. Really timely, beautiful book. I also recently read Laura McPhee Brown's upcoming Worry Doll, which I think will be published here in June. I'm a big fan of her work, and I don't want to spoil it, but it's a great book. And it was one of those which I read halfway through, I was deeply committed, I was completely in, and then it spins you around in a way that you just do not see coming. Really enjoyed that one. And I'm also about to go off to Aotearoa, New Zealand. So I'm about to read Struggle Without End by Ranganui Walker. And also, I just got it this morning, I'm going to read Patricia Walker's Potiki as well. So very much looking forward into getting into some Kiwi literature.
Okay. Well, lovely. What about you, Tom Wright?
I've just, over the Anzac Day weekend this year, had the pleasure of being at Sorrento Writers Festival, a writers gathering which is rapidly becoming almost compulsory in this country for its excitement and engagement. And one of the sessions I attended, I heard from a writer originally from Western Australia, Cameron Sullivan, and I just went out and on the spur of and basis of it, bought his novel, The Red Winter. This is a work of a genre that I do not read on any regular basis. You'd probably call it historical fantasy. It's set in the late 18th century. It's the story of a man who is immortal and has if he's a Sherlock Holmes that moves through space and time, he has his own particular Dr. Watson, who is both very real and yet very invisible. And the key mystery that they're seeking to solve is that of an enormous beast, a supercharged wolf that is marauding through the landscape, based obviously on the historical case of the famous beast that was at loose in the 1780s, running through the Majeride, the mountains there in southern France. The Red Winter, it's a different read. And so for those out there who are looking to move and expand their genre range, maybe go into a little bit of 18th century historical fantasy and enter into a different world. I enjoyed this book immensely and can recommend it as a good read down by the beach.
Okay, that's Cameron Sullivan, an Australian, and his book The Red Winter.
And don't panic, people. We will list these books in the show notes. You'll find it all online. You'll find it even attached to our segment on ABC Listen. So all of the books every week, they're all there. Don't panic. Thank you so much, Tom and Hannah, for joining us on The Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, wonderful to have you both. Hannah Kent is a novelist and script writer whose books include Burial Rites, Devotion and Always Home, Always Homesick. And Tom Wright is a theatre director and artistic associate at Sydney's Belvoir Street Theatre. And you'll find him pretty much at any writers' festival you can get to.
That's it for this edition of The Bookshelf. Next time, more from the International Booker Prize shortlist. How about Daniel Kellman's The Director, which is a German novel, and the Brazilian story On Earth As It Is Beneath by Ana Paula Maia, translated from the Portuguese.
Also, Elizabeth Strout's The Things We Never Say, and singer-songwriter Robert Forster is reading that one for us, of the Go-Betweens fame. And also, Portia Lahn's Homebound, and Geordie Williamson will review that for us.
I'm Kate Evans.
I'm Cassie McCullough. See you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.